Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this September 2010 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's sweet repast of science victuals, Jim Campanella. Let's just get started. First, on a personal note, as I mentioned last month, I was supposed to attend a scientific conference in Portland, Oregon. The conference I attended was the annual meeting of the Plant Growth Regulation Society of America. I have little to say about the science presented at the meeting, since I suspect it was more than a little abstruse for most civilians, even those actually interested in science. One odd thing I will mention, however, is something strange that I experienced. I had never been to a PGRSA meeting before, even though some of my colleagues have. Now, I'm used to scientific conferences that have attendees of over 1,000 people. Usually I go to the American Society of Plant Biology meeting, which has between 1,000 and 2,000 people attending. Well, this plant growth meeting was something else again. It had a total of about 75 people attending. Now, it's great to be noticed and known, but I also think anonymity is a nice thing, especially when there are hundreds of people in a room and you find the scientific talk being given tedious beyond belief and want to escape. It's nice to know that almost no one in the room knows or cares you are walking out. It is quite a different experience with less than 100 people there. Everyone notices everyone else, and whether they are present or not. Also, everyone tries to get to know you at a small meeting. And I am simply unused to having every person present in a room come up and introduce themselves. The other thing that struck me as unusual about the meeting was the number of scientists doing applied research work, as opposed to the pure brand of science that I'm used to. Most people at this Portland meeting were horticulturalists, not plant physiologists, who were more interested in how to get better fruit yield or fruit size than any physiological basis behind those things. It was both intriguing and disconcerting to talk to these applied scientists about my own work, especially since a good deal of my work has to do with a goal of better understanding plant protein evolution. The question kept arising of how I would apply my enzyme work to growing better plants, and, well, I didn't have a good answer to that except in a vague, hand-wavy kind of way to the future. And let me tell you, that kind of answer does not appease horticulturalists. I guess it was a little like a theoretical physicist chatting with an engineer about building a quantum computer. I mean, the common language is there for both of them. They are not speaking a different language per se, but the goals of each are so different that communication becomes very difficult because they are at cross purposes. Well, enough about my personal discomfort. Let's get on with the first story of the night. You may remember a recent story that I related to you about users of methamphetamine strangely having their powers of memory increased. Also remember, it was performed in lab animals, and there was no basis yet to believe it really happened very well in humans. Additionally, I just pointed out at the time that even if the drugs did help your memory, they did so much damage, it simply was not worth using them. Well, this first story is about further damage that amphetamines can do to the delicate mammalian system. In the August issue of the American Heart Journal, Dr. Arthur Westover at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center reported that meth abusers face a more than threefold risk of developing a tear in their aortas. For those of you who don't remember, that's the huge artery that carries blood out of the heart to the body. Physicians consider such a tear an emergency with catastrophic potential, and I can perfectly see why. There is actually a technical term used for this. Doctors call an aortic tear an aortic dissection. That should give you a hint as to how terrible it is. The authors say, quote, "An aortic dissection brings on the most horrible chest pain imaginable. Patients say, I think I'm going to die." And they're right. Without treatment, the fatality rate is ultimately about 75%, unquote. In the new study, researchers scan the medical records of nearly 31 million patients nationwide, ages 18 to 49, who were hospitalized between 1995 and 2007. Codes on these records show that 3,116 had an aortic dissection. The researchers also took note of codes that revealed amphetamine abuse or dependence. Statistically, amphetamine abusers faced a 3.3 higher risk of developing a torn aorta than non-users did. Researchers calculated that amphetamine abuse or dependence accounted for slightly less than 1% of all aortic dissections in the database. Aortic tears occur most often in older people at an average age of about 62, according to doctors. And there are about 10,000 aortic dissections in the U.S. every year. And less than a quarter occur in people younger than 50. Of those younger people, 1% or fewer appeared linked to amphetamine abuse, according to the statistical data. People with chronic high blood pressure are known to be at high risk for aortic tears. Amphetamine triggers adrenaline release, which revs up blood pressure and may partly explain the link between the drugs and the aortic tears. A patient with an aortic tear is treated with medication to lower blood pressure and lessen the strain on the aorta, and often the condition requires surgery to install a synthetic graft that replaces the damaged blood vessel. The overall fatality rate of all patients, treated and untreated, combined seems to be about 1 in 4. I guess all that makes it even clearer to probably steer clear of meth abuse. The next story is another in that long line of astronomic world records. Dr. Paul Crowther of the University of Sheffield and his colleagues described the largest star yet discovered in the August monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. The newly discovered star is about 265 times the mass of our own sun, Sol, and more massive than any other star known in the universe. At birth, the hefty star tipped the scales at about 320 suns, more than twice the generally accepted limit for a stellar newborn. Crowther examined massive stars in the Milky Way and the nearby neighbor, the Greater Magellanic Cloud. Four stars in the Greater Magellanic Cloud, dubbed R136, had temperatures more than seven times that of Sol and were several million times brighter and tens of times larger. Those properties, combined with the age of the four stars, indicated that each weighed more than 150 suns at birth. Theoretically, one of those, R136A1, was more than twice that mass when it was formed. Theoretical studies also indicated that such heavyweights could have formed only during the first few hundred million years of the universe, when its chemical makeup favored formation of such massive stars. Stars from 8 to 150 sun masses eventually die as supernovas. Even bigger stars from 150 to 300 suns may end their lives in even bigger explosions known as pair instability supernovas, which were once thought to have occurred only in the early universe. I guess that's no longer the case, although it seems unlikely that any astronomer is going to be observing one of those very soon, at least nearby our own galaxy, since there are so few stars of that enormity nearby. The next three stories of the night fall into the eyebrow-raising category. I think they are all kind of cool, but others might find them gross or even inappropriate. Let me give you fair warning before we continue that these stories involve sperm, penises, and poop, although I assure you those stories are quite separate from each other. Those who are particularly squeamish may want to skip ahead a few minutes in the podcast. Let's start off with the sperm story. A new study published in the July PLOS Genetics Journal and written by a team headed by Dr. Eugene Zhu of Northwestern University suggests that a gene called BOOL arose 600 million years ago and has been crucial to sperm production ever since. The BOOL sperm-producing gene appeared at the dawn of animal evolution and is present in every sperm-producing animal studied, from sea anemone to people. That result suggests that all male reproductive cells evolved from a common ancestor. Until now, scientists weren't sure if sperm production evolved several times in different animal lineages, or if a single ancestor started the ball rolling. Most animal sperm goes through strikingly similar developmental stages, which suggests a common origin. But no one had yet found a reproductive gene common to all animals until now. Zhu's team knew that 10 to 15% of infertile men lack a gene called DAZ, and that two ancestral forms of that gene, BUL and DAZL, are needed for fertility in a few other animal species. But the researchers didn't know if they'd find similar genes in other animals or whether those genes would also produce sperm. So the team searched through a database containing genetic information on a broad spectrum of organisms looking for key gene sequences that are common to BUL, DAZL, and DAZ. Fungi and plants lack the gene, which was not surprising, as did really ancient animals, such as sponges, but all other animal lineages, from cnidarians and mollusks to fish, birds and primates, did have the gene. Zhu says, quote, "This is strong evidence that the BUL gene is only required for sperm production in insects and in mammals, which diverged 400 to 600 million years ago." Unquote. Zhu's team then tested mice to be sure BUL was in charge of just sperm production, not more general cell processes. It turned out that the BUL protein was found only in mouse testes, and if BUL was disrupted, otherwise healthy mice did not produce sperm. Zhu says his team will look next in mice and fruit flies to see exactly where the BUL protein shows up, when it does, and what exactly it seems to do. There is a point to all this. With more study, researchers might be able to kill pests by specifically disrupting the insect form of the protein. Although they had better be damned careful, it does not have an effect on the mammalian version of the protein. Also, now that researchers know sperm genes are similar among animals, experts can study human infertility more easily in animal models than they could ever have done in humans themselves. Okay, onward to the penis story. Dr. Patricia Brennan of Yale University offered the first evidence in vertebrates that social circumstances influence penis size. She reported her work at a talk given at the annual meeting of the Animal Behavior Society. Okay, I'm sure that many of you have your jaws hanging open, gaping at the moment. But yes, Brennan's work does suggest that penis size changes depending on the social milieu. But this appears to be the case in duck penises, not human. From a reproductive standpoint, at least in certain animals, size does matter. Brennan's measurements find that the maximum length of a duck's penis depends on the company he keeps, and in this case, it's his fellow males who make the difference. Unlike mammals, a drake's penis substantially wastes away at the end of one breeding season and then regrows as the next season begins. Among ducks, the regrowth varies in length or time depending on whether males have to compete with a bunch of other males. In many bird species, males don't grow the specialized organs to deliver sperm. Ducks typically do, their penises sometimes reaching considerable lengths. In a ruddy duck, for example, it reaches up to 25 centimeters, which is more than half of its body length. That length may give a male advantage in delivering sperm when females have multiple mates. Brennan's work has previously documented strong sexual conflict in male and female ducks. It's common for males to force copulations. And for their part, the females employ strategies such as corkscrew-shaped vaginas, developed over the course of duck evolution, to thwart male control of reproduction, obviously making it harder to copulate. And you thought humans in single bars had a hard time getting together. To see whether competition among males influences penis growth, Brennan housed some of her drakes in groups of 7 to 8 males with just 5 or 6 females. Other males lived with just 1 female. Brennan reported that males competing in groups grew penises 15% longer and sometimes up to 25% longer than drakes with no mating rivals. The results shed light on how ducks became so well endowed compared with other birds, Brennan says. It also explains why some species of ducks have sexual relations which seem rife with conflicts, with males often forcing themselves on females in, quote, chaotic mating scenes, unquote. Brennan says, quote, "It's really like having a longer penis evolved in male-male competition, guy versus guy battles then could have started playing a role in battles between the sexes. The animals are essentially engineering their own phallus in response to social challenges. Unquote. What more could I say about that? And now, finally, the promised poop story. Sorry about this. Spending so much of my time with preschoolers does eventually have some effect. I guess that poop stories are one of those effects. Dr. Laurent Dormont from the CNRS, Centre d'Ecologie Fonctionnelle et Evolutionnaire, published a story this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology, which examines what kind of poop dung beetles like best. Now, I would never have thought that dung beetles have much of a preference. Poop pretty much seems the same to me, but apparently they do have a preference, and poop is not the same. I'm not alone, by the way. Most scientists thought it was only the general volatile compounds found in most dung that attracted the beetles, but that appears to be not the case. For those of you who do not know dung beetles, they spend all their lives from egg to adult in and around piles of dung. They hasten its decomposition, either by transporting it into the ground or consuming it. They are a very important and active part of the ecosphere. Dormont noticed that the beetles did seem to hang out with certain types of dung more often than others. He wondered whether a dung beetle's dung preferences are hardwired or set by the environment they encounter during their development. Dormont collected freshly laid French scarab beetle eggs from cow pats and fields around Montpellier. He brought the eggs back to the lab and settled them either in 1, fresh cow pats, 2, horse pats, 3, sheep pats, or 4, wild boar pats. I don't know where he got the wild boar dung from. After allowing the eggs to hatch and the larvae to develop into adults, Dormont tested the insects' preferences. He offered them the choice between cow pat and horse dung or cow pat and wild boar dung. The team was surprised to see that the beetles always chose to settle in the cow pat, regardless of which type of dung they had been raised in. And the beetles also preferred sheep dung, even when they had developed in horse or wild boar dung. Dormont said, quote, "This was a surprising result. We thought that the insects would prefer the dung volatiles in which they had developed, but when we did the experiment, the insect preferred cattle or sheep dung, even if they came from wild boar or horse dung." Unquote. When the team tested how the presence of other dung residents affected scarab responses, they found that the beetles avoided dung that had been colonized by other species, but happily settled in dung occupied by their own kind. Finally, Dormont teamed up with chemist Jean-Marie Bessière to analyze the volatile components from each type of dung to see if they could identify the compounds that the beetles found so irresistible. Dormont collected samples of each odor and analyzed them with combinations of gas chromatography and mass spectrometry. And he said, quote, "Jean-Marie Bessière is a flower scent specialist, so for him it was really new, and he was very excited to identify dung odors. He knows plant odors well. However, the volatiles in dung have been transformed by digestion, so it was difficult for him to analyze and identify these compounds." Unquote. The team eventually found that cow dung turned out to have the most complex odors, with 36 volatile compounds, while the wild boar dung was the least complex, with only 25 compounds. So far, that all means very little. Dormont is going to continue his research by identifying which of those volatile compounds the beetles respond to in an electrophysiological manner. In other words, which of those gases triggers the nervous system of the beetle to send a signal that here is the perfect place to settle down and call home. Yuck. I find the last story of the night particularly interesting since I observed some of these phenomena myself just a couple of weeks ago. While I was in Oregon, my family took a little road trip down the Columbia River. This is the big river that runs through Oregon and down past Portland to the sea. You may have heard of it in the Woody Guthrie song, popularized by Pete Seeger, "Roll on Columbia." Part of that song refers to the Bonneville Dam, which crosses this very large river and provides a good deal of electricity to the region. My wife, a native Oregonian, had never seen the dam. Oddly, I guess, like native New Yorkers who seldom visit the Statue of Liberty. Well, while at the dam, we witnessed something very cool. As part of the dam site, they had underground windows set up so that you could view the fish ladders of the dam underwater. Fish ladders, if you don't know, are special pathways set up that allow fish to bypass the dam and swim upstream to spawn. So my family spent a good 30 to 40 minutes just staring as fish were swept back and forth across this very fast-moving water, trying to swim upstream against a current which seemed well-nigh impossible to penetrate. We had to wonder how the trout and salmon we saw were able to live at all under such conditions. Well, a story in this month's Journal of Experimental Biology may have at least a partial answer to how fish live in such turbulent water. Dr. Anja Prisbila from the University of Bonn examined trout that seemed to be able to hold their position just to the side of and behind obstacles in rivers using only a gentle swimming action. This behavior is known as entraining. She decided to find out how trout apparently defy their turbulent environment and hold a steady station while in training. She placed a 5-centimeter semicircular cylinder in a flow tank with water flowing at about 42 centimeters a second. She then allowed individual trout to find a location where they were happy to hold station near that cylinder and film them swimming with high-speed video. She found that the fish spent almost 30% of their time swimming in the entraining positions, either to the left or the right of the cylinder's corners. She was also struck that instead of swimming continuously, the trout interspersed periods of undulating swimming with brief periods, lasting less than a second, of inactivity. Prisbila explained that during the period when the fish was inactive, it drifted back slightly, recovering its position quickly when it restarted swimming. The fluid dynamics acting on the fish must have been almost perfectly balanced while the fish was stationary. She then used computational fluid dynamics to build a mathematical model to explain the unexpected behavior. She and her team found that the angled fish's body behaved like an aerofoil, with the forces generated by the fast-flowing water between the fish's body and the D-shaped obstacle canceling out the lift and drag forces exerted on the body by the water flow. Prisbila says, quote, "The calculations pointed out that this is an energetically beneficial way of swimming because it is low cost," unquote. Finally, the team decided to directly visualize the fluid flows around a fish using lasers. Since there was no way to force the fish to swim in a thin plane of laser light, they built a model of a fish's body and positioned it in the water like an entraining trout. The flows behaved exactly as the model had predicted. So trout that live in fast-flowing water take advantage of the turbulence to save energy while in training. Again, I find this fascinating, but it still doesn't explain how they can ever make serious distance swimming upstream against such massive downstream currents. It just explains how they can keep from getting battered about by staying in one place while in training. Maybe that's their next project. Well, that's all for me from now. As always, take care. Look out for rapidly copulating ducks, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.